Hi friends, just a reminder that neither Jody nor I are physicians and none of the following should be considered medical advice. Also, in this rapidly developing situation, the best source of information on your community and the regulations and recommendations that apply is your local health department. If you're listening to this in the future, first of all, congratulations on being in the future. Second of all, just know that the beginning of 2020 was a complicated time. Now, please enjoy the theme song by Jonathan Colton. DNA, you're in my heart. DNA. Hi, and welcome to episode 22 of BioBreak, a conversation with your friendly neighborhood biologist. I'm Andy Walsh, and I'm here as always with my wife, Jody.
Hi there.
How are we doing this week?
Oh, absolutely nothing has been going on this week, right?
So quiet, so boring.
Just your typical boring fall week.
Yeah. So shall we start with the headlines and work away from there?
I don't see how anybody anywhere can avoid any of this.
Sure. So we're recording this on the 4th of October. It'll probably come up later this week. So most people are probably aware that President Trump is in the hospital being treated for COVID-19. And several people around him have tested positive and are receiving various levels of treatment and isolation and all of that. And of course, you know, we want everyone, including all of these folks, to be well. We don't want anybody to get this in the first place. We don't want anybody to have serious illness and complications. And we want all the people that do wind up getting infected to be well and get and recover and not have long-term consequences and all that stuff. So, that includes everybody involved in the most recent cluster of cases within the White House and the, senior national government.
I would say this has been one thing where this illness has kind of challenged me personally to be extra kind because, typically when you're cranky about things like, well, they just deserve to get this. And it's like, no, because that has so many, many bad ramifications. Like, I would not wish this on my worst enemy because then it just can affect so many other people. And so definitely do wish that we can all stay healthy and recover fully and not be so cranky about all of these things. But the fact that, he went into the hospital and got some treatments right away. I know the one was the Remdesivir.
Remdesivir? Yeah.
Saying all these names. But I was thinking that made a lot of sense because it's a steroid.
Remdesivir is the antiviral treatment. So it specifically targets the enzyme that allows the virus to replicate its genome.
Okay.
And as we're talking about, that's a specific viral enzyme. We don't have an exact equivalent because we don't make RNA copies of RNA.
Mm-hmm.
We make RNA copies from DNA in our cells. And so the virus has to have a special enzyme. And so it's a good target for viral therapies or antiviral therapies.
And the other one was the kind of like the antibody serum.
Yeah. So we've talked before, I think, a little bit about convalescent serum, the idea of taking the liquid portion of the blood from one or multiple people who have had the infection and cleared it. So the virus is no longer present in their system, but antibodies against the virus are present in their system. And taking those and, purifying them and so forth, but not necessarily just getting the anti-coronavirus antibodies. You're basically just getting all the antibodies, everything that's in that liquid portion of the blood, and giving that to another person. And that is a pretty significant treatment, right? Because you're taking a lot of protein from another person and putting it into your body, which creates a potential for your body to have an immune response to all of that essentially foreign material. So it's not an obvious treatment. It's not a no-brainer, everybody should get this kind of treatment. you know, not everybody may be a good candidate, depending on whether you're pooling samples or getting it from a single person, whatever. There's matching to do in terms of blood types and all of that. And, you know, there's a limited supply of it because we have to get a non-trivial amount of fluids from another human being. With a lot of these treatments, it has its caveats and its pluses and minuses.
But it's definitely, it's not like taking, you know, your typical antibiotic, you know, you could just do from home. Like, it makes a lot of sense, and especially given, you know, the president's, you know, he's older, you know, there are other health concerns, you know, being under, you know, the physician's care while being treated just makes sense.
Yeah. But actually, so he's not actually getting that whole convalescent serum treatment.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was just kind of setting that up. Yeah. That's what we've talked about before. But what he's getting is something we haven't talked about, which is a combination therapy of two monoclonal antibodies. So monoclonal means single clone. So now we've taken a single B cell that makes one specific antibody, and I isolated that from all the other B cells in a person. And it's an antibody that targets this coronavirus specifically in this case.
What are the B cells?
B cells are white blood cells, lymphocytes, part of the immune system. They're the part of the immune system that specifically makes antibodies.
Okay.
So that's the part that helps your body to remember antibodies for future infections. So you're not necessarily, so we're talking about like antibody levels after you've had the infection, and that those are going down over time after people's infection. And that in and of itself may not necessarily be an indicator that you're losing immunity, because you may still have the B cells with the gene for that antibody in your body. And those are called memory B cells, and their function is to remember what antibody was good against that particular infection so that you have it again the next time. You don't have to go through the whole process of basically adaptively or evolutionarily refining the antibody. You've already got that refined, highly selective antibody stored away in these memory B cells. So they can take B cells from a person, isolate the one that makes that specific anti-coronavirus antibody, and then take the antibody gene from it and probably put it in some other context where you can make lots and lots of that one protein. Might be bacterial. I didn't look and see what kind of expression system they're using. Sometimes it's bacterial, sometimes it's other kinds of cell cultures. But it's a way of just, we have ways of sort of on an industrial scale, essentially making lots and lots of one specific protein from one specific gene. And in this case, it's what they call a monoclonal antibody against this coronavirus. So he's getting two. One of them was isolated from a human who had the infection, cleared it, and, you know, consented to contribute material to be used in this way. The other one actually comes from a mouse that was genetically engineered to have a more human-like immune system.
Is it bad that I envision Pinky in the brain?
No, but it is kind of remarkable what they're able to do. Mm-hmm. We've talked a little bit before about how we've engineered different things, different animals, to have more human-like cells so that we can use them as models for studying these infections, so that they can get sick from a virus that might not have naturally infected them, and that they have a more human response to it. Well, now, in this case, we've engineered, and I'm realizing, as I say, it may not be genetic engineering, it may be like some kind of cell transplant, but one way or the other, the mice have a more human-like immune system, and so that they have an immune response to the virus then, that is very similar to the human immune response, and they got an antibody out of that. A slightly different antibody, but targets the same spike protein of the coronavirus. So we can now make these two antibodies in large quantities to use as treatment. They are both in clinical trials. They have not been validated. They're still doing some of the safety trials, as I understand it. But the president, under some mechanism or another, possibly compassionate use, which is one of these FDA things where a drug under investigation, under clinical trials, can be given to some patients based on need and severity and so forth. It's not clear that he necessarily needed it on that basis. It may have just been, you know, he's the president, he's kind of a high priority patient. Mm-hmm. Unclear. We don't really need to know.
Yeah.
I just, the point is more, you can't necessarily walk into your doctor's office and ask for these treatments yet. They are still under clinical trials. Their efficacy is still unclear. Their safety profile is still unclear.
But it's not necessarily something that nobody has, you know, only he has access to. It's,
right. We didn't make up something for him either.
Yeah.
Yeah. These are treatments that are being explored. There are people who are getting them right now as part of clinical trials. It's unclear what benefit may or may not have come from them for him, but I think they're kind of trying lots of things because of his high profile position.
Now, going back to the B cells, I had a question while you were talking.
Sure.
And was wondering, with, you know, is this something that we can test for just through like a typical blood test to find out if there's still the ability to remember how, just figuring out what immunity actually looks like from this virus, whether it's through, you know, catching the virus or the vaccines?
Yeah, that's a good question. As far as I know, there are no routine tests that could be done to look for memory B cells. Typically what you could get done at, you know, a local hospital or, you know, the local lab that your doctor's office might send blood work to, they're going to be able to do that antibody test where they can see if there's antibodies that B cells have made circulating in your bloodstream. But they can't necessarily detect the memory B cells. Those memory B cells aren't necessarily circulating in your blood. They can hang out in lymph nodes and other places like that. So that's one reason why they're not as readily testable in a blood test. And then again, it just, the test to look for that sort of thing is more complicated. And so a lot of labs aren't necessarily set up to do that sort of thing. So there may be markers of immunity that we're not necessarily catching just by doing antibody titers. Although a good, strong, highly specific antibody titer is a good marker for immunity, generally speaking. But the absence of it may not mean that you're completely naive. The other component, aside from the memory B cells, there are also T cells that are part of the immune response. The helper T cells that encourage, that stimulate the B cells to make more antibodies, and what they call the killer T cells that go around and target cells of your own body that have become infected and trying to shut them down before they can make enough virus to infect other cells. Both of those kinds of T cells can go through a maturation process, can go through a growth process of, you know, when you have an immune reaction to stimulate more of them. And so depending on your T cell profile, you may have some more, you may have a better immune reaction or not. So those are some other markers that potentially, if you were doing like a research study, you know, I've seen research papers on the T cell profiles of different patients. So it's something that can be tested, but not necessarily routinely.
I wonder if that's probably, you know, the next time to move on to the next topic of talking about vaccine development.
Yeah.
Or did you have more to talk about with?
No, we can move ahead. So the vaccines are largely, you know, where we left them. The couple of candidates are still in the big phase 3 trials.
But there was the big pause.
There was a
great pause around the world.
there was a pause. So it's amusing a little bit because, you know, these kinds of things happen all the time as part of clinical trials and nobody knows or pays attention. But this one, you know, these clinical trials are under heavy scrutiny. And so, you know, these kinds of standard administrative processes make headlines.
That's why I'm finding it's good to follow, like, real scientists on social media. Like, I follow a few of them, and it was funny when, like, all these stories came out about the drug trial being paused. They were the word, you know, the voice of reason saying, this happens all the time. Everything is fine. It will start up again. That will sort it out. And, you know, and yeah. And so you can also be our voice of reason too.
Sure. So we don't want to, you know, completely ignore their, you know, they did this for a good reason, right? Mm-hmm. If someone had a more serious symptom, an inflammation of the spinal cord or around the spinal cord, you know, that's potentially serious. As far as we know, the person eventually resolved that inflammation. In the reporting that I saw, there was not a report of whether they've made a conclusive determination of the cause. So that kind of symptom could be caused by a reaction to the vaccine, or it could be caused by some other infection that the person had overlapping with being a part of the trial. These things happen, right? You're looking at tens of thousands of people who are just out living their lives, doing all sorts of things. People get other kinds of illnesses and infections and so forth. So that's one of the reasons why, just because something like this happens during a drug trial, doesn't necessarily mean that there's a problem with the drug or the vaccine.
And also, you've talked before about how our immune systems have the same, like, functioning for the most part, but our immune systems react to things differently. And that's part of why we need to have more and more people to test things out on, to try these things out on.
Right. When you get down to a very specific molecular level, people have different immune systems. Their T cell, the kinds of T cells that they can make and the kinds of antibodies that they can make are limited a little bit. Even though we go through that mutation process, that evolutionary adaptive process to make new antibodies, the starting points for people can be slightly different. And other sort of supplementary aspects of the immune system, the proteins that present the little bits of virus to the immune system to decide, oh, this is something that needs to be reacted to, those can vary from person to person. And so that can vary which parts of the virus your immune system pays attention to. All of that, you know, can contribute to variation between person to person. So, yeah, just because the first 100 people that got the vaccine didn't have strong reactions to it doesn't necessarily mean that if we give it to 100,000 people, that there won't be some adverse reactions, that there won't be some strong reactions that require more medical treatment and so forth. So we don't know exactly, you know, again, based on the reporting that I was able to find, we don't know exactly what was determined in this case. And that's, you know, also partly, you know, we're still talking about people who are entitled to a certain amount of privacy in their medical treatment and so forth. But whatever the determination was, they resumed the trial. Either because it was decided that this was not caused by the vaccine, and so you just go ahead on that basis, or that the severity was manageable enough, right? We do have options for treating something like this in the rare cases when it does come up, and that it's still worth, the value of the vaccine is still worth the larger public health benefit, even if there might be some side effects. Again, I don't know that that's what they determined. But, you know, that is the kind of calculus that has to be done in these kinds of situations.
So we're back to waiting for, you know, however long until this resolves.
Yeah. You know, we are waiting to see what the outcomes of these phase three trials are. And they're, you know, around the world, I think there were up to 8 different candidates that are in that phase. I believe there are 3 that are happening here in the U.S., and, you know, some of them have said that they might have an answer to the phase three trial question by the end of October. Some are being a little bit more cautious about their forecasting. Regardless of when exactly we get the answer, so that's the first step of we get all the data, or we get enough of the data to be able to see a clear difference in the group that got a placebo and the group that got the vaccine being considered, and that the group got in the vaccine either got sick less often, you know, just didn't get infected as often, and or got severely sick less often. We want to see one or both of those things happening with the vaccine candidate in enough volume to make it worth administering to people. That's, you know, once we have the answer to that question, then there's a review process and a licensing process, right? And then there is the, well, now we actually have to distribute it, manufacture additional doses, and give it to people. So just, you know, because they might announce something by the end of October in terms of publishing a result, doesn't necessarily mean that November 1st, we can all line up at your pharmacy or your physician's office and get an injection of the vaccine. But it's positive progress in that direction, And like we talked about before, they are manufacturing some quantity of doses already. You know, there's some amount of this vaccine that's already sitting waiting to be administered if the answer to the question is, yes, it's effective enough to be licensed and administered.
Now, you've talked about how there are still multiple candidates that are at different stages that are still being tested out. When will all of those candidates continue through the process, or will we get to a point where some of them will be like, well, we have something that is working, it's not really worth it to...
Yeah, that's a good question. And a big part of it is, for better or worse, a financial question.
I'm thinking we haven't really had this kind of a scenario before.
Well, we have, not exactly on the scale, but we can look to, for example, the first SARS coronavirus back in the early 2000s. There were vaccine candidates for that. They made it part of the way through the clinical trial process. And then there really wasn't a need for them. So there was no funding for it. So they didn't go through. So there's no licensed vaccine for that virus. But not necessarily because there isn't a good candidate or because nobody put the work in it. It just, there wasn't enough funding. And there also wasn't enough infection going on to do the phase three trials, right? They're just not, you know, if nobody's getting sick, there's no way to tell the difference between the two groups. So, yeah, it's possible for vaccine candidates to go through phase one trials and then just stop because of whatever reason, or to go through the phase two trials and stop, or even to start a phase three trial and not complete it or something like that. So what will happen here? You know, probably a lot of all of the above. You know, there are going to be candidates that don't pass those phases, right? They'll do the dosing trials and the safety trials and the phase ones and the phase twos and come up with an answer of, oh, actually, this vaccine isn't safe enough to continue on, or this vaccine doesn't generate enough of an immune response to continue on. There will probably be candidates where they go, you know what? You know, the Moderna vaccine or the Pfizer vaccine or the whatever vaccine is 80-90% effective. Most people are getting, like, there's not much point in us continuing on. But I don't think the first one out of the gate will necessarily be the only one. You know, in part because there's a lot of phase three trials going concurrently that will largely kind of come out at the same time. And also because that first one may not be the best possible one. And so we may continue to want to explore whether there are refinements. Also, depending on who's been enrolled in the phase three trials, there may need to be more research done on vaccines for older people and vaccines for children. As far as I know, no children have been enrolled in any of the phase three trials to this point, so anyone under 18. So actually, this vaccine will not be licensed, assuming that come the end of this year or the early next year, when these phase three trials, the current phase three trials that are going on have ended, and they've had a positive readout of, yes, the vaccine is effective enough and safe enough to license, and we license them, will only be licensed for adults because those are the people that were in those phase three trials. So you and I may be able to get a vaccine sometime next year, but that doesn't necessarily mean that our kids will be able to get one right away. And then it may turn out to be that one of these other candidates is a better candidate for children or whatever. You know, we don't really know. You have to sometimes do the work.
So does that potentially mean that they might have to start kind of all over for having something for kids, or
wouldn't be starting over in the sense of going all the way back to phase one trials necessarily, but it would mean that you certainly have to do the phase three trials with children also. And, you know, this is a typical progression, especially for a virus that affects all ages and so forth. For a virus that was worse in children, we might have started with that population. For whatever reason, for safety concerns and so forth, generally speaking, you want to start with healthy adults to make sure, because they're the people who are most likely going to be able to tolerate
it. Yeah, yeah. No, that makes sense.
Yeah, so it will be another, you know, months of waiting through a phase three clinical trial, at the very least, to get something that's licensed for children.
So it sounds like, talking about children, sounds like maybe we need to move on to the next fun of, you know, talking about the fall surge or what has been going on. We now have, you know, most kids have been back in school for a month in various forms. And we've been watching the numbers, and the big question is this a fall surge? Is this a second wave? Are we still in the, yeah. Where are we?
Yeah. Well, and I think as always, the answer is, well, where do you live?
Yeah.
Because for some places, this is still very much their first big surge, and they're still in the midst of that. You know, particularly the states in the sort of northern Midwest that saw a big uptick in the late summer, they're still in that increase. And that was kind of their first big
increase. You know, they were the ones wave. That were like, when everything shut down in March on the East Coast and the West Coast, they were kind of like, but we're, what, why? And I can understand that. I mean, we talked about that at some point about how, you know, this is very dependent on regions, it seems.
Yeah, just because the virus has to physically move from person to person, and the early introductions were, you know, on the coast because of those places that have a lot of international travel. And because it was spreading in both Western Europe and in China and Eastern Asia, you know, both coasts were kind of affected about the same time. And, you know, obviously people travel to either coast from either of those places, but the numbers are more the, you know, European travel on the East Coast and Asian travel on the West Coast. And, you know, the middle of the country just didn't get that many visitors from those places, or even that many visitors from then the East Coast or the West Coast. But over time it has moved. You know, regardless of what was appropriate or not appropriate or necessary in March, you know, we're now at the point of, you know, they're seeing their first big surges. Other places, you know, New York and New Jersey, you know, have started to see a little bit of an uptick where they hadn't before. New York had been remarkably stable for pretty much the entire summer, and is only now, as a state, starting to see a little bit of an uptick. New Jersey started a little bit sooner with that uptick, but, you know, they're still about the same level per capita. Other places had a big increase earlier in the summer. You know, places like Georgia and Florida that had a big increase in, like, June. They're still kind of coming down from that and not necessarily seeing an uptick because of perhaps the mitigation that they put into place, you know. And that's a lot of what it comes down to. You know, the data still seems to suggest that distancing, being outdoors, wearing masks, all those things are helping to mitigate the spread. And so depending on that mitigation and the school policies and all of that, you're going to get different outcomes in different parts of the country, different states, different cities, different counties, different school districts, etc.
What I'm finding, like, looking over the numbers, and I don't do this every day because I just can't. I'm not paid to do it. but it's also, it can be stressful. But what I'm finding is, when I do look at the numbers, it looks like the country as a whole, the number of new cases have been pretty steadily on the higher side of things, it would seem, even though the individual states, it seems like we just keep, like, pinballing around to this state's going to be high today, this state.
Yeah, so it is interesting the ways in which those ups and downs in different regions and states and local areas do balance out or have balanced out. They're not necessarily guaranteed to balance out in all cases, but it just happens that since about mid-August in the United States, we've been roughly even. The recent trend is upwards, but, you know, it still looks fairly flat compared to the more dramatic ups and downs that we saw in March and then in May, June, July. And so that, you know, that's an interesting way that's kind of washed out. You can look at Pennsylvania and see something kind of similar, where Pennsylvania as a whole has been kind of flat for a while, but, you know, we had a big increase in cases around State College related to Penn State, you know, going back to school, and whereas in other parts of the state, things have been declining, and so it kind of comes out as a wash as you look statewide. And again, that's not always going to be the case, and so that's why it's important to not just look at big totals.
I think it points out how challenging it can be for, you know, people who do like what you do and you know, people who are making decisions for things, how to best interpret these numbers to make common sense policies that will help kind of, you know, manage things in the best way. So, like, thinking about how, you know, the case numbers are higher than they were, and you know me, I'm not good at numbers, but I'm thinking overall they're higher than they were when we were initially, like, back in March and April.
Yeah.
But because those were concentrated primarily in just a few locations, that's why we had the panic about making sure that the hospitals, you know, and specifically in New York, they were in a very dangerous place. But because it's more spread out, it seems like that's having a bigger impact in a good way, I guess. Okay, I got a lot of stuff there.
There was a lot. Let's see if we can kind of unpack that a little bit.
Okay.
So the national numbers of daily new cases are higher each day today in the recent past than they were at the first peak in sort of late March, early April. But that is more of a national pattern of spread than a highly localized spread. So in terms of hospital volume, we're able to manage that better than we were in late March and early April when it was all concentrated in New York City, Northern New Jersey, San Francisco, Washington State, and some other places, right? So there was a big concern in very local areas of hospitals being overwhelmed. And then there was a more hypothetical concern of hospitals being overwhelmed in the rest of the country if we just let the spread continue the way that it had in New York. Mm-hmm. So that's why we locked down everywhere or instituted strong mitigation practices everywhere to get the most benefit from it, right? Because you get the most benefit when you do it early in the outbreak as opposed to late. You know, New York, it took a long time, even after instituting those mitigation efforts, for the case numbers and the hospital volume to become manageable. But if you can stop the spread or mitigate the spread before you get to that point, then you can keep it below there more easily and you get much more benefit from that. But one of the side effects of that, or one of the consequences of that, is that it looks like what was never a problem here.
Yeah.
Our hospitals aren't overwhelmed. And so, there is a sense in which these high numbers of daily cases are manageable for our healthcare system. And so it's a little bit less of a sense of urgency at that level. At the same time, it is still a serious illness for the individual people, for some of these individual people who are having severe symptoms, who are having to be hospitalized. And so that's why we still want to prevent those kinds of outcomes for as many people as we can.
Well, to me, I even look at it as, I guess how I was looking at the numbers was, we're still this high. It would not take much for us to get very overwhelmed with case numbers this high.
Well, yeah, the concern would be that because we're already starting at a much higher level and then we're introducing things like going back to school and going back to universities and so forth, that now you have a large number of people who are actively infected, potentially getting mixed into new groups to mix with new groups of people and spreading in new patterns than what we've seen over the summer. Because all of those people are not necessarily aware that they're sick. As we talked about, you can be infectious before you start to develop symptoms. You can be infectious without ever developing symptoms. And so people can be going into school or university classes or whatever and not aware that they are, you know, potentially spreading it to the folks around them. And so, you know, that's why there is some concern about a fall surge, about, you know, an uptick with going back to school, and why we're going to continue to closely monitor that. I don't have any great you know, forecast it any different than what you get from other places. I definitely think that that is a valid concern. How it will actually play out will depend a lot on human behavior, what we actually do in terms of our mitigation, what, you know, independent of what the policies are. To some extent on the biology of the virus and if there is something different about cold weather versus warm weather in terms of the virus's activity or our immune responses, our immune system's response to the virus.
Was that something, because Australia has already gone through their winter, was that something that we were able to kind of look at how they kind of planned out, how the virus kind of played out down there, or because they seem to do a pretty good job of locking down, or maybe I'm just confusing Australia with specifically like New Zealand.
Yeah, so Australia had a little bit different story than New Zealand. New Zealand had that stretch where they didn't have any local cases. Australia, I don't believe, had ever reached that point. But they also didn't reach the high peaks that some other countries did. They did have a second wave of infection. You know, if you look at their curve, there's kind of two big peaks. They did have a second one over what was our summer, their winter, that was mainly restricted to one city and its areas. I'm blanking on which one that was, but I happened to listen to a podcast where one of the hosts is from Australia, and so he was talking about how it wasn't where he was, but it, you know, was a concern for another part of the country. So I think what that story tells us is, and, you know, there's also, a lot of spread going on in South America at the same time. So I think part of that story, part of what that tells us is that cold weather, transmission is still, is still possible, but it's not necessarily, I don't think there's a clear evidence of, oh, there's a strong seasonal component. And I think that's partly because it's still a new virus. Mm-hmm. It's still, our immune system, nobody's immune system has seen this virus before. And so you're going to tend to get big outbreaks and big clusters of cases in those kinds of situations, even if weather or weather-related conditions affect how well it spreads. You're still going to get summer transmission, you're still going to get winter transmission, and it probably will take a while, maybe several cycles, before we can really get a sense of whether there's an impact of weather and climate and so forth. What we did see in Australia fairly clearly was a reduction in the number of flu cases. It seemed to be related to mitigation efforts, because a lot of the things that we're doing to mitigate against this coronavirus also work against the influenza virus. So hopefully that will be the case here in the United States as well. There also was a big uptick in vaccine usage for the flu in Australia this flu season. A larger percentage of people got the flu vaccine than normally do in a given flu season in Australia.
And that's good, because, the flu is presents similarly to coronavirus, and, it can help the doctors to know how best to treat you if they know for sure what it is.
Right, and also the same hospitals can get overwhelmed if they have lots of flu patients or a combination of lots of flu and coronavirus mm-hmm. patients, which, is probably the most likely scenario if we're not doing what we need to do to mitigate the spread of both viruses. But hopefully we will continue effective mitigation strategies. Hopefully lots of people will get the flu vaccine, and we'll see low numbers of both through the fall and winter, and to the point where we're able to start thinking about folks getting a coronavirus vaccine as well.
And we wanted to talk about that one more thing with that kind of goes back to the immune system. You were reading about possibly developing immunity to it, even though we're not sick?
Yeah, so there's a hypothesis. This is not a conclusion from, intensive research studies. This is a hypothesis based on some preliminary data and some, just sort of basic understanding of the biology.
This is kind of like what researchers are looking at.
Right, well, yeah. So one of the hypothesis is that these masks are helping to create sort of an inoculation effect. So it's not a vaccine in that sense of getting an injection or inactivated virus or something like that, but it is exposure to a low level of the virus so that your immune system has something to respond to, but not so much that you actually get sick. And so the idea is that the mask is reducing the number of virus particles that you get exposed to, but not reducing it all the way to zero. And so your body maybe gets exposed to a handful of virus particles and starts to develop a little bit of an immune response to that, so that if you get exposed a second time, you can react a little bit more strongly and so forth. And maybe it's, you know, maybe it's a serial sequence of this. You know, it's not just one exposure, but it's the fact that, you know, every so often you're going out and your mask and other people's masks are reducing the number of virus particles floating around, but again, not to zero. And so you get just kind of a low level of exposure over time that builds up some kind of immune response. Maybe not enough to completely prevent you from getting sick, but maybe enough that if you do get sick, you only have the mild symptoms, not the severe, put you in the hospital symptoms.
And that's something that, like, they are seeing a lot of evidence that shows, like, how much virus you have in your system kind of is a good indicator of how severe your symptoms are going to be.
Yes. I think there's a clear case both for this virus and for many infections that the more of it you have in your system, the more severe illness you are going to have or you are currently experiencing. What's a little less clear is whether the amount of virus that you get exposed to in the first place affects how much your body ultimately makes. There is some exponential growth here that, you know, again, if you start lower, that can have a big impact later down the road. At the same time, it takes a certain amount of virus in your system before your immune system can react to it. So that may, it may be that even if you start with less virus, it can still ramp up to that number, and then that your immune system kicks out and kicks in. And so the differences between people may have more to do with the difference of their immune response rather than the difference in the amount of virus that they had in the first place. But it's a reasonable hypothesis, just a hard one to test, mm-hmm. that the amount of virus that you get exposed to in the first place can impact your ultimate clinical progression. And so, yeah, tied with that is, you know, that the mask might be one of the impacts of the mask, in addition to just preventing people from being exposed in the first place, is this sort of low-level subclinical exposure to help kind of train your immune system.
So wear your mask.
Yeah, so another potential benefit of wearing your mask. Seems like a good place to stop.
Yeah, I think that's about all we can handle.
Yeah, good note to end on.
Hopefully next week is boring.
Maybe many weeks ahead be blissfully dull. But until such time, you can get in touch with us if you have questions or comments or something you want to hear about in a future episode. Maybe a book you want to talk about. Maybe we'll try some more sci-fi discussion. You can get in touch with us at BioBreakPod on Twitter, or BioBreakPod@gmail.com for email, or you can look for BioBreakPod or BioBreak Podcast on Facebook, or BioBreak.podbean.com if you want to look for the actual podcast site itself. There's not much there besides the episodes of the podcast. And we will talk to you next time.
Bye. DNA, you're in my heart.